Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Joyce Carol Oates, whose latest novel is The Grave Digger's Daughter. Earlier novels include Blonde, Them, Wonderland, Belle Fleur, several other books, collections of essays, short stories, and a very interesting book that came out, I guess, within the past couple of years, The Faith of a Writer. Let me start by asking you about the particular inspiration for Grave Digger's Daughter. I know that some of it is autobiographical.
The inspiration basically is memories of my grandmother, and it's a fictitious account of a person who actually lived. And she lived at a certain time, long before I was born. Her childhood and her young girlhood are just sources of a kind of hauntedness, I guess you could call it. I've been haunted by this material for many years in my life and really felt compelled to write about it.
Was Rebecca then the character? Was that your grandmother?
Yes. Rebecca is a fictitious character based upon a real person who was my grandmother. I should emphasize that this is fiction. Sometimes I don't invent events, but I try to imagine them.
In that case, was your grandmother a gravedigger's daughter, the daughter of an immigrant who came over from Germany?
Yes, that's true. My grandmother was a gravedigger's daughter. And there's so many ironies that this Jewish family would leave Europe, leave Germany, and come to upstate New York where there were no Jews, and try to live in that rural community, which is a very rough, somewhat primitive community, and try to pass themselves off as non-Jews. They were non-denominational, basically. And so when I knew my grandmother, which is much later in her life, of course, she was a person who seemed to have no history. She never talked about her family. They were all dead, and she never hinted at any girlhood or difficulties of her own. She was one of these people, and there are both men and women like this, but I think there are many, many women who are in this role, who live for others, who are wonderful mothers and grandmothers, and they just live for their families. They're very warm and loving, but they never talk about themselves because their histories, their personal histories, are painful.
Now, your grandmother lived long before Rebecca, which meant that her parents came over for different reasons than Rebecca's parents, who came over because of the Holocaust.
That's right. Well, the Holocaust had not happened.
Right, yet. Yeah.
But there was a feeling in Germany, if you were a Jew, that there was a virulence that was gathering as early as 1936.
What year did they actually come over?
They came over in the 1890s.
That's what I figured, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they came over. They obviously wanted to erase all their memories. It must have been a very sad, painful experience that they were coming from.
Did you ever get a chance later in life to sit down and discover things? For instance, Rebecca, she's never informed that she's Jewish. The only way we know is because of the names of her family.
Basically, that's it. Well, one can surmise. I mean, she's intelligent enough as an adult to be able to figure things out. And she has a certain look about her, and some people say, are you a gypsy? Because she has some dark features and very dark, thick hair.
Joyce Carol Oates, you've been writing for a long time. Is there a reason why you never got around to this particular tale?
I wanted to write about it for years. It's hard to answer that question. Sometimes we don't seem emotionally ready to write about something. It took me several years to feel that I was capable of writing my novel Blonde, which is about Norma Jean Baker, who becomes Marilyn Monroe. That turned out to be a monumental novel to me, monumental in the sense that it was almost my tombstone. It was so difficult to write and so long. But I seemed to know beforehand that it would be a difficult novel, so it took years to get started. So, too, with The Gravedigger's Daughter.
Some of these other books, then, for instance, Black Girl, White Girl, was that something where it just came up and you said, ah, there it is, and it just poured out of you in a different way then?
Well, Black Girl, White Girl is a much shorter novel,
right,
and it has a different structure. I have another novel of that type called The Tattooed Girl, and those are essentially written to a structure that might be analogous to mysteries, though I don't use a mystery formula, but it's about a central event that's a mystery, whereas The Gravedigger's Daughter is about a person's life. The time span of Black Girl, White Girl is only one school year. It's just 1 year. It's very short time, whereas The Gravedigger's Daughter takes place over many, many years.
So in that sense, when you are working on a book such as Black Girl, White Girl, you have that structure set. You know where you're going. And on this one, it's real amorphous then.
That's right. That's why it's much, much more difficult. I did structure it very carefully. Writers never really know whether people notice these things, but there are many, many parts of the novel that are sort of interwoven with other parts. If something takes place on page 15, it may have an echo or a resonance on page 500. But I think that most readers just read, and they're not necessarily looking for these structural unities.
In that sense, a novel like Gravedigger's Daughter is almost a symphony, if you want to look at that with motifs replaying in different keys.
Well, I think that's a very good metaphor, yes. And then the other is more like a sonata or something that's a little clearer and doesn't have as much going on.
Joyce Carol Oates, when you're writing other kinds of books, there might be a little more freedom to make up in terms of history, but in this case, you want to get it right. I mean, that means requires extra research, or does it?
It is a novel. I have to imagine things, but I don't really feel that I would have to research them. I did a lot of research for Blonde. I saw all the movies of Marilyn Monroe that are available on film and on tape. So I definitely had to do research for that. This is more of a private story. It's a personal story, so it's not necessary to do very much research.
I was talking to a writer not long ago who says it doesn't matter if you get absolute perfection in the details as long as the reader thinks there's absolute perfection in the details.
Well, I think that's true, but if you are a writer who values realism, you do want to get it right just for your own sake.
In looking at a book like Gravedigger's Daughter, there are three sections to it, and each is different. And the focus tends to be on the first section, because that's the section mostly, it would seem, about your grandmother. But one of the sections concerns a piano prodigy. How did that come into the mix?
My grandmother had such hopes for my father that he would be a violinist, and she bought him a violin. The violin is on the wall of my study. My father passed away some years ago. And in actual life, my father only took lessons for a few years because they were so poor he had to drop out of school to work. Whereas in the novel, the young pianist is able to be financed. He does have lessons. His life is more like my life, where he's able to have a career in an art. And so I can join myself with him, and in a sense with my father. It's kind of a sort of a metaphorical composite figure.
Then who is Gallagher, the man who eventually meets Rebecca?
Gallagher is somebody whom my grandmother actually did not have in her life. She didn't have that kind of charmed life. But he's somebody of a kind of man that we all meet at some point. I'm actually very happily married. My husband's not really like Gallagher, but a man who's really a decent, generous, kindly, basically very nice man. And not that he's perfect. He has his own foibles. He exists. I mean, people criticize my writing sometimes for saying that my portraits of men are very harsh. But I actually do have men like Gallagher in my novels who are very nice men. It's just that because they're not brutal and don't do anything too dramatic, people don't notice them, but they're there. And I thought he was a wonderful person. He is a perfect husband for Rebecca, who calls herself Hazel Jones. He doesn't really know who she is.
It's interesting that he forms kind of a bookend to Niles Tignor, the mean first husband, who almost forms a bookend in a weird way to her father.
Her father, yes. Well, there are different kinds of images of masculinity that are sort of thrown up, in a sense, by circumstances. What do we mean by a man? A very masculine man is needed in some context. He must be protective. He's the strong person. He has to be dominant. He has to take care of his wife and children. He's a strong person, takes care of his family in, shall we say, a state of nature. You know, that's a masculine role. But then in another kind of society where this man starts to lose his role, he may not be physically as strong any longer, maybe a little older. He may lose his job. And once a man like that loses his economic position, his role in society, he can be made to feel inadequate. But he's the same person. Niles Tignor becomes someone like that. He starts losing his own sense of this masculinity, And like many men of that type who would be protective of their families, once they start feeling inferior and insecure, they turn against the families. It's completely unconscious.
The character of Niles Tignor, was that a man in your grandmother's life then?
It may have been an exaggeration. I don't know. I never knew my grandfather, who bore the name Oates. He was Irish, and he was very charming. He was evidently very, very handsome and charismatic, and he broke my grandmother's heart. He may have been abusive. He was an alcoholic. He left her when she had a very small child, who was my father. So I think of the Irish side of my family as being emblematic of charm and charisma and mystery and elusiveness. The Irish are the ones who break your heart, quote unquote. I'm not saying that all Irish people do this, but to me that has a kind of emblematic significance.
One other question before we look at some broader issues, which is what happens to Jacob and Anna, her parents, that key moment in the book. Is that based on something that happened in your grandmother's life?
Yes, something like that did happen. Not completely. I didn't want to give away, but basically, yes. So my grandmother came home from school one day, and her father was there, and he had a shotgun, and he was sort of waiting for her. That did happen. When I was writing the novel, I thought that my grandmother, whom I only knew as my grandmother, and who never, ever, ever talked about her life, so that we never knew about this only came to light after she had died, that she must have been very lonely in her life. She had no one to talk to. As far as I knew, she was my grandmother, and like most children, I was very selfish and just thought, well, this person is here in our family to love me. I mean, it never occurred to me that she had a life that predated even her own son, you know, that she had a life as a girl.
Well, how did you find out about that particular incident then?
It came to light when someone was researching my life to write a biography.
Really?
Then I found out that my grandmother had worked in a factory. She had been a chambermaid in a hotel, and she had a difficult life. I'm sure people in the family knew these things, but the children were never told. Families are very reticent about unpleasant facts. They don't want to talk about depressing things. So there was just no memory, and my grandmother never, ever talked about things like that. She never complained. She was the nicest person. She was like the dream grandmother. She gave me books for my birthday and Christmas. She gave me a typewriter. She sold clothing, you know. She never hinted that her own life had been so painful.
There's a moment we're in Rebecca's head, and we discover that, in fact, at the store that she's working at, she's deliberately become kind of this mythical figure for people to see. And when you learned about your grandmother's real history, did you suddenly see that same, you know, she's creating this person?
Yes, she creates the persona. There are many people in the world who do that.
Sure.
So Norma Jean Baker did that when she became Marilyn Monroe. You know, you dye your hair platinum blonde, you put all the makeup on, you present yourself in a certain very breathy and sexy way in terms of Marilyn Monroe. And as I said, my grandmother presented herself as a very loving person. Now, in fact, she was loving. I mean, she actually was. I think she made a decision at some point in her life that she was not going to dwell upon the past. Some Holocaust survivors moved forward in their lives, and they were very cheerful. Well, cheerful might be extreme, but they were very positive and looking forward to the future. Others looked back. And I wouldn't judge anyone who looked back. I tend to feel that I probably would be somebody who would have been scarred by the experience. I'm not sure I could have been strong like my grandmother and moved into the future.
This brings up the entire idea of reinvention. You mentioned, of course, Norma Jean in that book. Reinvention seems very American. In The Gravedigger's Daughter, as well as, of course, you know, in Blonde, we have several characters who reinvent themselves, not merely Rebecca, but her father, who denies his past, Niles, the husband, who's reinventing himself almost on a daily basis, Gallagher, the boyfriend, who throws away his heritage, in a sense, and reinvents himself. They're all doing reinvention.
Well, that's a way of looking at it, but Gallagher acknowledges who his father is. He has a radio program under his father's auspices.
Sure.
He's challenging his father's conservative politics. He's a liberal Democrat. His father's a conservative Republican. So I would say that Gallagher doesn't change his name, for instance. But Rebecca comes to a crisis in her life. She really has to change her name because her husband, a man she thinks is her husband, he probably had not really married her, but he's probably going to chase after her to kill her. And she discovers this Hazel Jones. She cuts her hair. She smiles in a different way. She wears makeup. She loses some weight. She presents herself as much more of an American, optimistic woman, like a cheerleader, like June Allison. And people like women like that. People like women who smile. People don't want women to be heavy-hearted. That's popular culture.
There's also a subplot involving a ship that's turned away. The ships like that did exist.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Was your family ever involved in that, or was that just you brought that in?
I don't know about the Jewish side of my family. I can't imagine any history of the German Jews who did not come to this country. I can't imagine any history that would not have been tragic in some way or painful if they hadn't left Europe. The memory was just all erased. They changed their name, and then they never talked about being Jewish.
Morgenstern is the name of the family that comes over. That was your grandmother's original name?
That's right, and it was changed to Morningstar.
There's a very strange, I liked it actually, but a strange kind of epilogue to the book that happens many years later. Why did you put that in? Was that always intended to be there?
Yes, that was Rebecca being united, in a sense, with her lost cousin because she had thought her cousin had perished in the Nazi death camp. But in fact, her cousin had managed to survive. And it was very sad. And yet I felt that at the end of the novel that Frieda would go to see Rebecca and that the two would be reunited so many years later. I have kind of a fantasy of my lost cousins, that I must have had cousins whom I never knew, and I must have had them, I guess.
You're listening to an interview with Joyce Carol Oates, whose latest book is The Gravedigger's Daughter. Joyce Carol Oates, your book, The Faith of a Writer, I was looking through it and I found some interesting quotes. One is, anything that happens to me as a writer has been precipitated by an action of my own. And that's a handwritten reminder that you keep on your desk, or say that you keep on your desk. That means that you have to take full responsibility for everything you've written, right?
Yes, I think so. It might have been an interesting experiment as a career just to have a pseudonym, you know, and to write under a different name. I'm not sure how that would have worked out.
Well, you have had pseudonyms.
I have had pseudonyms in sort of a short run. I don't know. It's very hard to be a writer or to be an artist, I think, and it annoys people, and there's a feeling that you're transgressing or you're standing out from your fellow or your sisters or something. So there's a feeling that some people would like to punish you, you know. I think of a woman like Hillary Clinton, who is so much a target. It just seems every time you look at the newspaper or a television program, somebody's criticizing her in the most extreme terms. And it just seems so sad in a way that she is an outstanding woman. You may not love her, but there she is. And there have been so many men who are aggressive and it would be considered that strong leaders. But when a woman does something that seems a little bit out of the ordinary, she becomes such a target. So it's not that I think I'm on that level, because Hillary Clinton obviously has this great world stature, and I don't, you know, imagine anything like that for myself. But I just feel that it's a very ambivalent role to have.
Well, I think we know that strong women tend to be treated rather abruptly in the media.
But also there's a certain element of jeering and mockery. It's maybe not as much today as there was before women's liberation, so-called women's liberation. But when I first started writing, it was before that time, and I just took tremendous criticism mostly from male reviewers and some women reviewers too, because I was writing about subjects that women had not usually written about. Women usually written about domestic subjects and motherhood and family novels. And I actually liked those subjects very much, but I was also writing about men, and I wrote about the Detroit riots, and I was trying to do different things, and I did take a lot of criticism.
Do you think that women writers then have it harder than male writers in that way?
Well, I don't want to sound self-pitying. It's the one thing that I don't believe in, actually. Speaking in a very objective way,
yeah,
I would sort of think twice about encouraging a daughter of mine or someone with whom I was very close to be a writer, except I would say maybe right under a pseudonym, or maybe I'm being too pessimistic about it. I mean, my own experience is not everybody's experience. I mean, there are many, many women writers who are very proud of what they've done and very secure and confident, I think. And I may be just somebody who's, I don't know, I have a certain personality that's unique to myself.
Well, Joyce Carol Oates, speaking of that, you say that writing is primarily remembering, and by that, it's not remembering the past of your grandmother, it's remembering what you wrote when you were running or walking. Is that pretty much it?
Well, I try to imagine the scenes or a whole novel before I write. I can't really begin a story until I've written, worked it out in my head. So I never really start writing, and therefore it's very frustrating. I spend a lot of time thinking about it and walking and running and trying to meditate. I guess the word meditate is probably the best word. I'm sure that there are, in all the arts, there are people who experience these moments of inspiration, like a musician hears the music and then he'll have to write it down. But maybe if he doesn't write it down right away, he will lose it.
You've also written in an essay called To a Young Writer, your forbidden passions are likely to be the fuel for your writing. Do you find that's the case for you?
Well, I don't really know, because most of our creativity is unconscious and we don't really know what we're doing. I feel that I'm trying to memorialize certain people and certain, I think, acts of bravery and courage against difficult odds. That seems to me what I think I'm doing. Other people criticize me for doing that. You know, they see something very different in it. It's hard for me to talk about my own motives.
Do you think that if you were to read a lot of your books and come out with, you know, these themes that constantly repeat on an unconscious level, it would almost be a distraction, because then you'd be looking for it as it was coming up?
I think it would be a distraction. It's very easy to become distracted. To be a writer or an artist, ideally, and I don't really have this quality myself, but I think ideally one should feel that one is quite unique and has something special to say, and that though one may be misunderstood or criticized or ridiculed, that it doesn't matter. And I think very strong writers like D.H. Lawrence or James Joyce or Hemingway and Faulkner maybe were able to feel that way. But sometimes the writer needs to drink or take drugs or something to get to that state, because to have a feeling of confidence in yourself is something that may be acquired. I don't know that it's inevitably natural. I mean, I don't think a little girl is born, a little girl or maybe a little boy either, is born with confidence. Where do you get confidence from? You have to get confidence from your parents, maybe, or your elders kind of instilling it in you. But by nature, most of us are insecure. I mean, most of us, I think.
Do you feel that way every time you sit down and write a book, then?
Well, I feel completely insecure and undefined. I get caught up and lost and immersed in the work itself, and I try to fulfill the work the best I can. Then when I'm outside it, I'm a different person, obviously. I felt a sense of triumph and a thrill of happiness when I finished The Gravedigger's Daughter. I mean, do remember feeling that way, as if I had accomplished something. But now, a year later or so, again, I have these feelings of insecurity. I'm not sure.
Not long ago, I talked to John Banville, who said that every book he starts writing is going to be the greatest book, the book that changes the world. And then when he's done with it, he looks at it and goes, my God, this is a piece of junk and it's a failure.
Well, I would never have thought the book would change the world. I mean, that's actually no book, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that was more metaphorical.
Maybe he was
yeah.
just being ironic. No, well, if I felt the book was junk and a failure, I wouldn't send it to my editor.
Really?
Oh, no. Well, of course not.
But how do you necessarily know? I mean, can you really know that?
Well, if you've written a number of books, I guess you could have a sense of something.
Are there novels that you've kind of finished and looked at and said, my editor will never see this, no one will ever see this?
No.
So it never happened.
Well, why would it happen? Suppose you were a carpenter and you'd built 15 houses that people liked and they bought and they paid money for, and then you built a 16th house and you were pretty proud of it. Why would you not assume that it would have the same reception as the others?
Yeah, well, the only reason I mention that is because you had said if there was something like that, you would never send it in, but there never has been.
Well, I keep working on it until I feel that it is finished.
So you'll work on a book for many years, put it aside, come back to it.
I put the Gravedigger's Daughter in a drawer for a year, but it was finished at that point. I think of writing as a kind of spiritual endeavor, and I'm trying to give life to people who may not be able to speak for themselves. I just think that the human spirit is very, very mysterious and wonderful, and I'm trying to memorialize people who are not themselves writers, and memorialize ways of life that may be vanishing. I mean, it doesn't seem like a criminal activity. You know, it doesn't seem that it should be met with punishment or anything.
Do you work on more than one book, more than one novel at a time? I mean, I would gather short stories and essays are a little different.
No, not usually. I have to just focus on one.
Do you have any works that you're in the process of revising then, even as you, for instance, like The Gravedigger's Daughter sat for a year, anything like that?
Well, I took it out after about 15 months and reread it. And when we reread something we've written in a very intense and emotional experience and reread it later, we have much more of an editor's eye. It's you're much cooler and detached at that point.
Well, when you looked at it after 15 months, you were happy about it, obviously. How did you feel reading it and reading this? Because in a sense, the Joyce Carol Oates of 15 months ago who finished the book is not the Joyce Carol Oates reading the book right then.
Well, when I read, I just give myself up to the reading and try to identify with the characters and see how the language expresses it. I was actually very moved at the ending when the cousins are writing to each other, because it's a sort of ending of my grandmother's life that I think she actually did not have. I think she ended her life as lonely as she had been, in a sense, because there was nobody from her background and nobody to whom she could talk. She couldn't begin to talk of the things she's experienced. How could you really not be lonely when people didn't know who you were? But in the novel, she was reunited with a cousin.
It's kind of interesting that a novel concludes, but a person's life may just end.
Yes, that's right. Works of art come to conclusions, but most of our lives just go on and on and on until they stop.
It's kind of one of the reasons why I think biographical movies usually don't quite work, because they don't have that story arc.
Well, that's true. They don't usually. That's a very good point. Also, dramatic scenes in movies are enhanced dramatically when they're cut. A scene is very intense, and then it's cut, and we skip to, you know, a week or a month later. Whereas in real life, the scenes go on and on and on and on, because there is no end to it.
Well, when you're writing, is there a piece in your brain that's doing the cinematic thing, doing that cutting?
No, I write the whole thing out, and then I would cut back.
Okay.
So, to me, most of my writing is longer than anybody ever sees. The chapters are shortened. You trim and you condense. You know, I think, well, this scene could be put in with this scene, and the two of them could go on page 90, you know, and then not have the second scene and then move it faster.
When you're working at that point, you've moved from longhand to your computer, right?
Well, I have a typewriter. I actually don't work in a computer.
Really?
Yes. Well, that is the only way I can write, actually. It's sort of an old-fashioned way. But I didn't want to look at the computer screen all my life. I had a computer for 2 years. I was very mesmerized by it and just stared at it for long periods of time. And I would rather look out the window.
You wrote at one point, if you yearn for people who won't reciprocate your interest, you should know that your yearning for them is probably the most valuable thing about them, so long as it's unrequited.
Yes. Yes, that's a kind of a slightly cynical remark. Yeah.
Do you think that idea plays a role in The Gravedigger's Daughter in terms of Gallagher?
Gallagher yearning for Hazel Jones?
Yeah. Right?
Well, he never really knows Hazel Jones.
Yeah.
And women, and perhaps men too, have to confront in their lifetimes the fact that if they completely reveal themselves, they may lose the object of their adoration. If you tell everything about yourself, all your insecurities and all your your yearnings and frustrations to another person, you may be repelling that person. And I think it's something that we all learn instinctively, just to hold things back, to not tell everything. We all have relationships based upon just partial selves. I would never dream of telling my students, for instance, anything of my personal life, especially any difficulties. I would never think of doing that.
It finds its way in your books, then, kind of under the surface.
Well, I'm not necessarily writing about myself. I could be writing about other people.
Well, of course, but you know, after having interviewed people for 30 years, there is a sense that on some level, since it's all coming up from the unconscious, it is you. I mean, it's you disguised, manipulated, turned around, twisted, folded, but it's you.
And sometimes it's an enhanced person.
Yeah.
By way of research and revisions, we express ourselves in language much more articulately than we do in our speech. So it can be a multi-form and very, like a multifoliate self that you find in the work. Then when you find the actual person at a later date, you may discover a much less complex person or less interesting person.
Joyce Carol Oates, having written this, have you begun work on another novel?
I have. I'm in a state, I guess, of that chaos that comes when one is not exactly finishing a novel. There's a feeling when you're finishing a novel, when a novel is being revised, that you're much more in control. And then there's a state when you're not exactly writing at that level where you're much more groping. I guess that's the word, groping. And the word groping seems to suggest frustration and difficulty, maybe some disappointment and impatience with oneself. So that's the phase I'm in now. I'm much more in a groping state. And I come from a phase of being revising and editing, which is very good and very positive. If you were a sculptor and confronted with a huge block of marble, and you know that there is a beautiful shape inside that, but at first you're stymied. You don't know where to strike first. You don't know how to get that shape there. But then if you keep on working, I guess, something emerges from the rock, from the mineral, and then you have a shape, and then you can refine it and polish it and make it beautiful. But the beginning is so difficult. That's why I said a few minutes ago, I'm not sure I would encourage a daughter or a relative of mine whom I love to be a writer or maybe to be any kind of artist, because it is so difficult. At the same time, the rewards can be great, too, and one can sometimes feel some satisfaction.
Then suddenly the work goes out to the world and it's gone and you're confronted with that big stone block again.
Yes, the stone block is a confrontation. Unless one gives up completely the way Shakespeare did, and people don't know why he gave up. He was writing at the top of his powers in The Tempest, and yet he seems to have wished to give up. And I find that everybody who writes about Shakespeare finds that very mysterious that he would give up at that point.
Well, you couldn't imagine doing that yourself, though, right?
Well, I could imagine maybe giving up publishing. I could continue writing in some way, but I'm not sure that other people would have to see it. I never understood J.D. Salinger, who gave up sending his work out, and I guess he continues to write.
I would hope.
And why did he do that? Millions and millions of people revered him so. That's a very interesting story, and one day it will be understood.
Well, I've talked to writers who've made the comment that the book that they write is only 50% of the experience of the book itself, and the other 50% is the reader. So he's only getting 50%. There's just these words.
Well, I'm not sure. I just don't know what to think about it. Salinger's written some of the most wonderful prose of the 20th century, and in America anyway, and he's had so many readers who loved his work, and people always talk about him even now, decades later. Yet he must have felt some revulsion for the world of being a public figure. He must have turned against it for some reason. But as I said, to me, it's a mystery.
And the sad thing is we don't know until he dies what there is, if there is anything, and for all we know, he's burned it all.
Well, that would be a tragedy. He
yeah.
might burn it.
Yeah.
No. I don't know. I hope not. But it's been decades.
Joyce Carol Oates, final question. If you're a reader looking at a book, reading a book, is there anything you're looking at in particular? Is there anything that says to you, this is a book I need to read, or is it just haphazard?
What you mean, like if I'm in a bookstore browsing?
Yeah.
Well, I love to browse, and I'm somebody who could be in a bookstore happily trapped or locked in overnight and or locked in for a week, and I could just browse all the books. I open the book and start reading the beginning.
That's it?
Yeah, and I see what the language is like and what, and look at the, I have to admit I do look at the dust jacket too and see what the cover is. And if it's by a writer whom I read before, obviously, that then I have a certain predilection.
When you look at your own work, can you pick out books that, in retrospect, you go, this is the book that I was meant to write? Or do you only look at the most recent one, like a lot of writers do, and say, well, that's the one, until the next one?
I don't really think of my writing that way.
Really?
Each one was a separate project and demanded a certain language and a certain form. I try to do my best with each work, and so then I move on. And I really don't compare them. I have a novel called Missing Mom, which was an experiment in simple sentences, declarative sentences, without any irony. It was a novel that was meant to be simply told, almost like conversation. Then I have a novel, Blonde, which has very long sentences and very complex structure and very complex point of view, a posthumous narration. It's a postmodernist novel. And then I have mystery novels. I mean, they have all different intentions and different structures.
Now that you've written Gravedigger's Daughter, do you think you've fully told the tale? And do you feel comfortable that somewhere, if your grandmother is looking down, she's going, I think you got it?
My family never had any great sense that they were important people. I felt that they were important. But they lived very modestly, and I think they would be very touched.
You've been listening to an interview with Joyce Carol Oates, whose latest novel is The Gravedigger's Daughter. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.